it didn't work. I fell over. But in front of people instead of just by myself.
Well, at least he had it in you to give it a go. Like, that's something, you know, a good test of character.
Thanks.
Yeah. Do you have the ego, or are you confident to just give it a go and see what happens?
I think I try and balance out the confidence or the arrogance to just give it a shot when I need to. Try and balance that out with respect for the effort that the viewer has made to get there.
Yeah, that's a valid point.
Yeah, because I don't want to be disrespectful.
No. But you never know, maybe that could have been the best thing in their day, watching you fall over.
Such a gift that I've given.
No. Take what they take.
What are you busy with thinking about lately? Or like working through? Or
I feel like a lot of things. Maybe because the last few weeks I've been very much not thinking about dance, or I have been, but through doing non-dance things, like doing this yoga course and then now teaching a lot. And being away from dance in a very specific way has been really good, because it makes me understand first why I dance and why I want to make dance work, choreographic work, and then also why as a person I'm drawn towards yoga and how that relates to my practice. And then now the reverse, going back to thinking about dance and making work, I don't know, something about how interests are mutually exclusive, but they're also not.
Yeah, not at all.
And then I have been thinking a lot about this work I'm making for the Next Wave Festival next year. And
what's ideas. Do you have got a title for that?
I don't know how official it is, but okay. At the moment, to me, it's called Admission into the Everyday Sublime.
Cool.
Yeah, which was kind of, you know, the first title that I thought of when you write the first grant for money and you're like, okay, what is this project called? And that was the first one that kind of came to mind and it stuck. And I feel like my process is a lot like that at the moment. And so I'm working a lot with impulse, but I don't know where the impulse is coming from. And at times I try and track it, and then at times I just don't track it, and then either way I just give in to it and say, well, that impulse hasn't gone away, so therefore it's part of the work already, whether it ends up being the work or not.
Do you mean, when you say track it, do you mean trying to work out if it's intuition or ego or anxiety, or
a little bit,
or do you mean trying to like justify it or know where it has come from?
Kind of both, like you know, in terms of things, like I'm working with three other performers, and there's me, one other dancer, and then two sounds artists, and even decisions about like the roles people take, or feeling like everybody has to have time in the performance to kind of, not as a solo exactly,
but to like celebrate them or something.
Yeah, but then I track where that comes from, whether it is this like democracy within performance, or like me wanting to be a democratic choreographer, but then also is it just that the work needs that?
Yeah, and what are you serving, the work or the people within it or the audience or?
Yeah. And then beyond that, like where is that idea coming from as well? Like why does it pop into my head? And why does it stay there? Yes.
And so what about the non-performative element, or the non-people element of your work, like the sound or the lights or things like that?
I think this is kind of how, I mean, I feel quite new to making work. It's only been maybe 3 years since I've been thinking and making my own work in a particular way, and I have kind of developed this real feeling that within my work each element has to be equal, because I mean, I think a lot of people also feel like this, like the sound is not separate, it is completely part of the work. And so is the lighting. I feel like I have been really influenced by other people's, other artists' artwork, visual artists, who work with light, like James Turrell. And so my experiences of their work, where it's all about light and colour, remind me that it's inherently a big part of the work, and that's how people see the work anyway. So not to neglect it in any way, but that actually just believing and trusting that it is equal as a performer or as a performative element. So I guess that is part of my process and how I think about the choreography of the body, and then how I don't know really anything about how to produce sound in the way that I feel it should be or need it to be for each work. So then how can I make sound through the knowledge of choreography and the body? And similar with light, I feel like light is the last element that often comes into a show. Maybe the costume comes even before the light. But why shouldn't it not also be there before you think about the movement?
Yeah.
So I think this is a big part of my thinking, like how can I use all the knowledge I have about my body and choreography and techniques or modalities for choreography to make decisions or choreograph light and sound and the density and weight and qualities that they have within them the same as I would think about choreographing a body or space, body and space. I don't know if that makes sense.
It makes a lot of sense. Okay. How do you think about choreographing a body in space?
I think that is very intuitive.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, and whether it's my own body or other people's bodies, or body, like a material object as a body. So basically anything that interferes on the space, including light and sound. But then, yeah, the physical, like, human body, I guess it often comes from, or recently it's been coming from this feeling this intuitive feeling I guess I have of what I want the end result to be, which is the way it enters the bodies of the audience and that experience and how they take that experience away.
Yeah.
So in a lot of ways I feel like I work from the end or start at the end and then just fill in patches as I go, and I don't really have a clear process for that, but it's just desire, maybe.
No, I really like the idea that there's all these other words that we can use as synonyms, like impulse and intuition and craftsmanship and training and intelligence and decisions and negotiation, but at the end of the day it's just what you desire to happen. Like you're listening to your own desire.
But something about when you just said intelligence, like I feel like intelligence and desire are really linked, but not necessarily a mental intelligence. But yeah, so I guess another thing is like using, I think I've written this in my bio, and it's one of the things that stays in my bio every time, like you like working or utilizing the inherent intelligence of the body, because I think a lot of people think of dance and go, oh, I can't do that.
Yeah.
And that always, I kind of, are you burning?
Yeah,
I don't know, I always find that a bit funny because, yes, maybe they can't dance like me, but I also can't dance like you, Matt Cornell. Do you know what I mean? So
yeah, but
so we share different things, but everybody's body has an intelligence, like, they say, how can you remember steps? And it's like, well, I'm not actually remembering steps when I'm improvising. How do you pick up a cup the same way every time?
Yeah.
And it's like, there's already this kind of inbuilt intelligence to work out or negotiate a situation. And I think that that's what improvisational dancing is, both as a process and in performance. It's like negotiating the situation that you set up.
Yeah. But what do you think about literacy? Because I would say that I position, say, the ability to dance alongside the ability to read or write, in that you need to be the level of literacy you are with that form will influence what then comes out when you write, or what comes out when you dance. And so I think it shouldn't be belittled that we've spent 10 years working out how to dance like Lillian, or working out how to dance like Matt.
No, of course, because that is a lifetime of work. You know what I mean? It's never, because the body's changing in every day in so many ways. It's ever work.
How did you get to what kind of dancing you are now?
Well, I guess like a lot of dancers in Melbourne at the moment, I
went through VCA. Me too.
Yay. And I was super young when I was there and was very into the ballet streams.
Mm-hmm.
Whenever there was a choice to be made between something contemporary and improvisational, I would always choose the point version or the ballet version of something.
Mm.
And I feel that has shaped a lot about how I dance now. Not how I think about dance, but maybe just the information in my body.
Yeah.
But then I've also worked really hard to... Once I left VCA, I think I learned a lot. And spent a lot of time in the studio with Philip Adams and Ballet Lab. And people like Brooke Stamp and Luke George. My good friend Rennie McDougall, who was also in my year but just a bit older and always a little bit wiser, was, you know, already working with the company.
Like,
and
physically wiser?
Physically wiser, and just had a real sensibility about thinking about artistic practice, which I think I was just really young. I just turned 18 at the end of third year.
Holy shit.
Yeah, so I kind of didn't know much in a lot of ways. Or wasn't open to learning things that I already didn't know.
Didn't already know.
And then since then, things have spiraled out of control.
Yeah, tell me about this. It sounds exciting.
I just, you know, you have those times where you're not at school anymore and you have to make your own choices.
Yeah.
And that's when you learn the most about yourself, about your interests, where you've come from and where you want to go, and maybe where you think you want to go, and then you realize you don't want to go that way, or or your interests actually lead you somewhere else. And so I just have spent a lot of time in Europe, especially in Berlin, just trying to see what there is that's not here, and then also coming back here and realizing what's not there. And that kind of informing the kind of work I want to make too. Not just in terms of, you know, oh, it's Berlin and maybe there's no dancing, people just talk on stage. And not just going, I don't want to make that, but kind of questioning why that's happening and why I connect to parts of it and why I don't.
Yeah.
And we were talking about economics before, and I just went to this talk at the M Pavilion about economics. And kind of just that sort of travel time raising a whole lot of thoughts about the economics of dance, whether it's political or financial in a non-political way, if that's possible.
Yes, that's possible.
Yeah, or just like the economics of a body moving, or the choice to do that and to not do other things out of everything you can choose to do in life, to choose to do that.
And if we're... Let's flip it and give weight and power and leverage to choreography and say the choreography of economics and the choreography of finance and the choreography of non-political finance.
And the performers within that?
Yes.
Yeah. But it's interesting because that is the thing, like, especially now, I guess the last few years, of course... performance art has been a big part of the visual arts, and dance and choreography has come into the visual arts
again
for decades and coming back again. And this is interesting to me as well, and how people are starting to think about choreography in terms of material object that doesn't have its own agency to move, so like architecture and the choreography of architecture, or Yeah, and whether that means that you can choreograph architecture without acknowledging the people activating or engaging the space, or I don't really know what they mean.
No, I think it's interesting to consider consent. Those that will embody whatever choreographic form you're authoring, and the fluctuating level of consent people care about from their dancers in company or independent situations, and how much credence is paid to it and how much is not. But then also just the rise of people who want to choreograph things that they don't need to ask for consent from those things, because they're not choreographing on people anymore, and they're choreographing on structures or steel or financial constructs.
And I think it totally makes a difference whether people claim this to, claim that they're choreographing in some way. Because a lot of people do the same activity, but then some people label it as a certain thing, and that changes it drastically, because the act is kind of nothing without the audience or the observer. In some ways, and then in some ways you don't need the observer and it has its own action.
What do you think about the power of ephemerality?
I think it's hugely important, and I think that is because I am a dancer. And I think that being a dancer has really influenced the way I think about everything else and every other engagement I have, and also the people I've come across in dance who have thought that way have influenced the way I think about that. But then I also, I was doing this workshop on notation with Acca at the RMIT Design Hub this whole week, and this thing about notation having to be material
and explicit.
But then also eventually by the end of the week, we start breaking down, well, what is material? Memory is material. It's just as material or immaterial as a note that I write but never look back on. And so then this starts to get interesting in terms of ephemerality, of both movement and thought and process in movement and thought.
Yeah, I think the biggest power of notation is to talk to yourself across time.
And then this is another thing that was raised, kind of who is the audience, or who is the notation for? Thanks. who is the notation for? And that's kind of something as well I was thinking about in terms of working with other people in a process. And I have the most knowledge about what's going to happen next, but also I don't, because I provide a prompt maybe, and then it's kind of out of my hands depending on how much clarity I give. And then there's another thing that came up, clarity in notation, because
towards the explicit,
I
like the idea though of prompting your future self. And so it's like a little gift that you give to your future self by making the bed in the morning.
Yeah.
And you're like, future self, you're going to come home, you'll really appreciate this. And that can be just as much a form of notation. Well, it can operate in the same mode as notation does, which is, say, open up your 2016 journal or daily planner and put a smiley face in the middle of it, and then forget about it. And then when you get there one day, it's like, I wonder what that's about. That's
What was I
thinking there?
At that point?
And what's implicit in that is that your past self did something for your future self, and it doesn't matter about it being explicit.
But I think this is another kind of argument that I was really pushing for in this workshop. I don't know, the sense that time is not... It's that thing of time not being that linear. Mm. So there is not something now for later. I don't know, I guess kind of like if I'm working with people, or say I write myself a note, or maybe let's say, so maybe let's say I'm in the studio working with somebody and I'm giving them information to prompt an experimentation, then they give me something back.
Mm.
And then if I work with them on another project, whether it's in the near future or the far future, I've given them something and they've already given me something back from before, and now we're revisiting that, but after a lot of other stuff has been loaded on top. So in some way, this, like this as notation in terms of dance and the body transmitting and transposing information and mark making, like what is mark making for the body, you know, you're always doing action, and so each action is like, I don't know, a painter's mark. But then there's also the mark of whatever that experience imprinted on your body.
Yeah, muscle memory.
Yeah, or
and
just
trauma.
Yeah, trauma. And, you know, imprinting experience, because no experience is really lost. The moment that you might think you lose it. Like, how often do we go through our day and not realize that there was a sound in the art center playing over the loudspeaker really quietly, but we didn't know it was there. But the second you walk back in there, maybe 10 years later, and you hear it playing, you remember that, oh, maybe it does always do this.
Yeah.
I don't know if I'm talking in circles, but maybe it is actually about going in circles.
Maybe. Well, I was wondering about that. I don't know. Time, my thoughts on time at the moment is that there is no present moment, that the current does not exist, that there is only what has happened and what will happen. But if I switch, if I like center the human viewpoint right at the middle of considering time, then I imagine that time is everything that we remember and everything that we imagine. And I remember that so much of what we are told about history, or that we remember about history, is not true, or it changes over time as we learn more information or get exposed to different ways of thinking or have more experience that gets imprinted on ourselves and our self-definition. All we realize, maybe, like my friend did recently, that there is history of indigeneity in his family that he didn't know about until he was 30. So that's going to change his history.
And everything, yeah.
And that possibly there is no difference in mind action. I don't know this physiologically, but it's a nice place to move from and think from it, is that there's no difference in the brain from imagining your past and imagining a future. Remembering your past and remembering
like
your future,
or what happens neurologically,
like,
is the same.
The delving into the little soft matter.
Yeah,
it's the same activity to imagine something, whether it has or whether it is yet to happen.
Yeah, this, I really like this thought, and it reminds me of this lecture I went to at Gertrude Contemporary. Amelia Barrican spoke. She's a academic, but she spoke about this idea of sound fossils, which I just kind of immediately hooked onto. And she was kind of speaking about, this imprint. So everything, every action that happens imprints itself sonically because it's vibration and it's material. It imprints itself in its surroundings. So like this marble, is it fake marble or real marble? Concrete.
I'd say it's
thing.
Real.
Real fake
marble. It's a shrine.
Marble. It's a shrine. But anyway, so us sitting here talking now is imprinting vibrational material into the space.
Yeah.
And it doesn't have an opinion on that. It just happens.
And it doesn't have a visual impact onto
No.
it.
No. And
it
might not have...
impacted.
It might also... I also don't know enough about this, but it might not even have a physical impact.
Mm.
But there is something about memory...
So we're bestowing inanimate objects with history and memory
and
experience.
But it's also giving that back because it's imprinting on something with our body. Uh-huh. We're sitting here. Uh-huh. Anyway, and the other part of what she was saying that struck me was that So say an archaeologist finds a fossil of
that
something.
Burger.
Finds this burger encrusted into the marble shrine in 50,000 years.
Yeah.
That person is then connected back to this moment that we are here also experiencing this half-eaten burger on the marble shrine. And so therefore time, these two points are connected because they have discovered something about this time in their time.
Mm.
And so that as a concept of time,
yeah.
that there is no present maybe, but that there is always everything.
That there is always
everything.
Well, you
know
everything.
That thing of
sure.
It's a bit meta, but that every experience exists and you happen to fall into one experience or out of one experience.
Yeah,
then
and then you construct it for yourself
you
the longer
it
you stay
your
there.
Yeah.
And you let it change you. And
but then, of course, there is also linearity, which we can't say. You can't just say there's no such thing as linear time. It just exists within that bigger time, maybe, because if I take a step forward, I'm moving forward.
Yeah.
And I get from place A to place B.
Yeah, there are some, like,
time.
There are some laws of physics which we're bound to, but maybe working in response to currently perceived fact is not the nicest place to work from all the time.
Exactly. And I think
I feel like the church doesn't let fact get in the way of where they work from. Any church, any
yeah.
organization that has, like, a completely other theologian basis.
Yeah.
They're like, fact, yeah, but
but that's kind of what how dance operates too, isn't
yeah.
it? Or art in general. Like,
yeah, you allow yourself to step away from fact so that you can try coming in back into this real thing
yeah.
differently from a different spot
exactly.
as a different person.
And I think it's often using non-fact or like fake experience
yeah.
to find something real.
Really real.
But do you know what I mean? Like,
yeah, and then everything gets hyper as well.
Yeah,
everything.
Like how many times in dance do you do fake ritual? How many times
well,
have you
I don't
encountered
think
that?
Ritual can be faked. I think if you do it, it's a ritual. Like the ritual of having tea. There
yeah,
is there are Western tea ceremonies as much as there are Eastern ones.
That's true.
But the from my position having been raised in the West, the Western tea ceremony is not other to me.
No.
So it's not like exoticized in that way. But I'm interested in what you're saying about sound, because sound feels like this in some ways one of the most subtle and also one of the most pervasive
yeah.
forces to impact and imprint on a space.
Yeah, well, I mean, sound is whole. Like, we can't escape it.
Yeah,
I mean,
and it happens over time.
And it happens over time. And I was thinking about this. I don't know if you know Anna Seymour. She's a dancer who is beautiful and she's deaf. And she made a choice when she was younger. Apparently, she could have hearing aids, but she made the choice not to because it gave her a certain sense of sound. So it was like this electronic digitized sound. And she decided she didn't want that
yeah.
experience. She would rather go through life having a more natural, real experience of what was happening, which I find really brave. And I think about, yeah, when sound is happening, but maybe you don't perceive it, like going into the art center and the sound is over the loudspeaker, but you don't hear it because somehow you block it out with your attention. So like what other things are, what other forces are in action that we might not perceive, like how some birds can see ultraviolet or animals see ultraviolet and we
yeah.
can't.
Yeah.
So
or
there's
even
other things happening and they're not part of our daily experience, but they're impacting on us because
yeah.
they exist and therefore
yeah.
we're absorbing it somehow.
Yeah, cool. How do you think about sound when you're making? Or how do you use all of what you were just thinking about in the context of making a show?
That's a good question. We, for this next wave work, we've only had 1 week of development so far, which is maybe a bit naughty of me, but I feel like I'm thinking about it a lot, so it's happening. But most of that week, even though we were in the studio, Chunky Move Studio, big, beautiful, clean space, We were working mostly on sound because I felt that finding something in that first.
Yeah.
Yeah, I just felt that, how to say this? Maybe the information was already is already enough in the body that it needs to be transcribed through another another medium first so that it can then feed back and the body can find a new way of approaching it.
Yes.
So that it's not habit of the body deciding what the sound or other elements will be, but yeah, the quality of light and the experience of another element really letting the body step forward in some way, even like kind of consciously but unconsciously, like not going, okay, now we have that sound, let's improvise to it and it'll be different than if we didn't have sound, but the act of thinking about these ideas in that form, which is foreign to me in so many ways, that gives more information from my body to then have a dialogue with the concept.
Yeah, I've been thinking about when you're talking about form that's foreign to you, and if we're talking about linear time and sound being one of those things that happens over time, I've been thinking about how there must be a lot of people these days that are making music who are visual people because there are so many digital options to lay tracks out visually and to represent sound visually.
Yeah.
And to tweak it, not by turning a knob and hearing how that sounds, but watching a bar or a chart that feeds back the precise frequencies.
Yeah.
And just how crazy it is that a lot of our popular sound is possibly, like, in forms of music as well, is possibly being made by people who are making it visually, and digital audio workstations as a form of notation that is not a reference to or separate from the event.
Yeah.
It is creating the event. The notation of sound, the visual notation of sound, creates the sound. And then when we finally get it, we're not looking at it anymore, we're listening to it.
Yeah.
But somehow, it'd be like, I guess it'd be like cooking from a cookbook, but just not tasting it before you.
Yeah. Yeah, that's interesting.
Send it to someone? I don't know. Just thinking that, like, there are people who are oral people and people who are visual people. And
I think maybe I am an oral person. I mean, one of the things that we played with, well, I kind of just said to the team, like, I want to know, or we were just talking about like resonant frequencies and that, you know, all matter has its own resonant frequency. And I think I just said, like, something really boring, like, what does the body sound like, or, you know, what does my arm sound like?
So poetic.
Yeah, and lame, totally lame. But then Atticus was like, well, wait a second, and he did some computer typing and was like, he was like, I think I have something. Oh yeah, that's right, NASA have somehow logged, I don't know, I mean, I don't really know how this works, because there was like a frequency for the forearm, a frequency for the hand, I don't know what,
like whose hand,
what part of the hand, is it the muscle, is it the fascia, is it the blood going through the veins, like, I don't know what that is, but the fact that there was this notation and this like label that said at the forearm vibrates at this resonant frequency, and then we were like, okay, well, we'll see what a few different parts of the body are and just transpose that into real vibration, sonic vibration, and just listen to what that sounds like.
Yeah.
And it's kind of funny because it kind of has no impact on me. Anyway, I was like, well, that kind of, it's a bit boring. Like, it's just, you know, long drones of one frequency. But then it's like, well, is that how we carry ourselves through this world engaging with different other matter, like just as lumps of frequencies. I don't know.
That's nice.
But then, yeah, also not wanting to be like, ooh, the frequencies of my body interacting.
What, where does that sit for you? The like knowing that you're doing something tangible and valid and with purpose and seriousness, and the flip side where you're like, ooh, dancing the frequency of my forearm. Like, where does that swap over, and how do you know when you're crossing the line and when to step back and when to go full head on into it, into either?
I think if it comes into my head, I have to go full on in, and then at some point you can back away or you cannot. Yeah, I think maybe that's the part of me that's impulsive. Like if I decide that something's interesting even for a moment, it has to be fulfilled or something.
Yeah.
Otherwise, I'm always wondering, like, what if? What if? I think I'm one of those people. But then sometimes you say something out loud, like you suggest it to the group, and that's where it ends. You know what I mean? Because you go, and it's often when you decide, no, actually, once I said that out loud, I really maybe mean it in a different way. And so I might not throw it away completely, but now that I've said it, I know how to reinterpret what I mean.
Yeah.
Or I understand I have to reinterpret and try a different avenue of investigation for this thing, because it came from somewhere, so it's valid, but where it's going to go is... that's the kind of danger point.
Yeah. I think. Well, that happened to me last week. I was thinking about epigenetics being...
What's epigenetics?
It's like there are genes, there's genetics, and then the way that those genes turn on or turn off or are expressed in response to their environment.
Okay.
That's epigenetics.
That's me.
And I thought, well, maybe if you can construct environment, you can choreograph at a genetic level to turn things on and off.
That's amazing.
Yeah, and then when I said it out loud, I was like, oh, that's just selective breeding. Like, that's just animal husbandry. That's just domestication of dogs over generations or whatever. That's exactly what you're doing, is altering the environment and then whittling it out. And then it goes into all this other crazy territory, like superior races and eugenics and shit like that. But it was a fun idea when I thought of it, and then as I said it out loud to somebody, just hearing the words like back into my own ears reminded me of all the other things and the
I think this has a place though, and in just, it just made me come back to my own project for Next Wave. Because it is about, I mean, I don't know if I've ever spoken to you about it, but it is, or the desire to make the work kind of came from this, this idea that, well, one of my collaborators who is so incredible, he has had some big health issues with brain tumours, and when we were performing a work I made for Fringe last year, he had this and was having, you know, seizures once or twice a day. And then just snapping out of it and being fine again. But I was kind of like, wow, that work was called Noise Quartet Meditation, and it was kind of about this thing where the performance would serve a purpose to give a certain experience, a meditative experience to people, but through this experience of noise or chaos. And I kind of was thinking in that process, like, wow, how great would it be if this dance, this choreography, had the power to heal or like provide some better well-being for him, because I just, it was like heartbreaking to see somebody you were close to and working with every day like suffering with this thing both physically and emotionally, and realizing how lucky I am to be so healthy and so emotionally stable, like as I have been for a while, because I know that it goes in and out of that for people, but for a while I felt very solid, and I think that's amazing. Nice.
How did that happen?
Just circumstance, both things that I make for myself and things I have in myself, like, you know, really good friends, or, you know, like things like that, good family, a good partner.
Luck.
Yeah, luck. Luck with career.
And luck.
Yeah, luck with my career as well. Like falling into situations. I mean, not just falling in, but like me working in a particular way and inviting certain situations to happen, but then them also giving back. So things not being one-sided in any way. And also not me just falling into luck all the time, but having to earn it and then acknowledging that. And yeah, so this new work is kind of building on from that, looking at alternative therapeutic experiences. And you're talking about epigenetics and me hoping that this work, or the whole concept behind this work, is that every audience member will leave with somehow an increased state of well-being, whatever that means, whether it just means they feel relaxed at the end, or whether it means they feel tired and will sleep better that night, or whether it means they feel energized, whether it prompts a certain kind of positive thought or a negative thought, but then later it produces a positive thing. So yeah, kind of this very abstract sense of well-being. But yeah, like how can certain sonic frequencies actually sit in and resonate with the body to allow muscles to relax, or how can looking at a certain color for a long time affect mood through that really cellular level. So yeah, these kinds of things. So it's kind of like, yes, I really, not that I want to alter people's genes, but how can performance do that, like as a question? Yes. Actually, like, because when you're inside the performance, you are very much being altered through the process of doing. And so how can the audience member, even if they are just sitting in their chair, looking front, absorbing the performance, how can they also get an experience that enriches well-being? So, I don't know, maybe in like some way, it's wanting to like really give something to people that's in, you know, abstractly but tangibly positive. But then maybe it's also, I don't know, I've been thinking, like, is this an egotistical thing? Like, is it something like, I want to help people? Like, does that come into it at all? You know, like, what am I getting from making this and giving this experience, and what are other people receiving from it? Like, what is the balance of that? Is it egotistical to think that this is possible and a good thing that everybody wants and apply for money, maybe receive some? Yeah, and then the economics of that. Just coming back to economics, like, yeah, I don't know. You can position it in heaps of ways, but it's just interesting to think about that stuff. Like, what is the act of making this performance doing? Where does it start? Where does it end? How is it positioned in my practice now? Like, at this early stage of my making life, what will I make next? Because I also was speaking to Ange about this, and sometimes I feel like a lot of artists, their first work, their first major work is, or first minor work is like all their ideas, their important ideas in one work, and then they go on to kind of reproduce it in different ways. And I feel like this work is a reproduction or a reworking of my last work. But so will it ever do anything more than that other work did, or I don't know.
Hopefully you'll get better at it.
Yeah.
I hope that I get better at, but if I zoom way in, I just think about a relationship that I'm having with somebody and think about the way that I can love them in that relationship, then I hope that every time I reproduce or recreate my love for them, that I'm doing it differently or better.
Yeah. That's nice. No, but it's really interesting too. Like, I mean, we're talking about dance, you know what I mean? And like dance performance, dance thought, dance choreography. And I don't know, love is a big part of that, I think.
Yeah.
I don't know, like, I was just about to say, like, you know, maybe you love the way you dance, and I don't mean like the way you make love, but like, you know, people always say things like that anyway, joking about dancers, and it's like, well, actually, what does that mean? Like, because actually it's the way I think. You love the way you think, but it's also separate to the thought. But yeah, just thinking about that tying in of everything and how actually you always are the same person that you are.
Yeah, so you're...
So everything is... Yeah, the output of everything has to have some common thread. You can't... I don't know, like maybe if you have multiple personalities, schizophrenia. But I think even then, there's a common thread.
There's like a construct of how to think, and there's a construct of how to love, and there's a construct of how to physicalize.
Yeah.
And that,
but you have to navigate, you can only navigate those constructs as your own being. And then there's that, I don't know, maybe I've been, I keep on referring to yoga things, I think, just because I've been thinking about it a lot, but, you know, yogic philosophy is really that, you know, everything is, you're doing everything, or you practice yoga as a broader practice than just doing poses, but like as a philosophical practice and a way of life to attain samadhi, which is complete oneness, I guess, with everything. And so this idea that, you know, my most inner being is also what's making up that burger or this marble or you or
the helicopter.
Helicopter, but also the sound that it's producing or the air flowing, like that at the center of me is also the center of those other elements. I forgot why I was saying that. I guess I just like, since kind of starting to think about that a lot, that's also really influencing the way I think about asking the body to move. Or act or whatever for the purpose of choreography.
Yeah.
Like.
Yeah.
And it's not that thing, it's not that question, like, that big meta question, like, why dance?
No.
You know, but it's like, well, why...
And anyway, why dance is totally different to why choreograph.
Yeah.
Or why dance is totally different to why do choreography.
Yeah, exactly.
I don't really have a problem with why dance, because I give validity to my desire to dance.
Yeah.
And sometimes I don't have the desire, but I know that that's just a result of my surroundings and environment, and that I'm not in the space physically and mentally to have the desire.
Yeah.
And so I will, as Rhianna Newton has told me, I will generate heat by... going to a space and putting a song or two on. The most recent one is that recent Missy Elliott song.
I'm so untrendy.
Okay. I'll play it for you later. But I have a response to that that makes me want to move a little.
Yeah.
But if I've made sure that I've got enough space around and a little bit of uninterrupted time, then that will spill over into moving a lot. And then as soon as that is activated, as soon as that... the environmental factors of desire to dance, like physical readiness and mental readiness and validity for what I'm doing, is activated enough to spill out, then the question doesn't exist anymore.
Yeah.
In the same way as the question of why talk.
Exactly. And I mean, you know, if people do have a problem, I mean, people do have a problem with these things, like...
Like they want questions. To dance, but they don't know.
Yeah, or even just having this. Yeah, but it's kind of like, well, if there wasn't a problem, then it wouldn't. I don't know. I mean, I don't know if I really believe this either. But like, you know, some people have this attitude that if there's not a problem, then it doesn't need to be done because you don't need to know anything more about it.
Hmm.
Or something like, if you already know everything about something, then there's no more desire to. Do it or engage with it because you already know everything. That knowing being like really physical too, and not a mental process, this thing of once it starts to spill over, something shifts key. And
I like talking with old B-boys or B-girls with, like, who were around in first wave in the late 70s. And then we're jamming or whatever, and I'll ask if they can just talk me through doing an air track or a swipe or something. And I've often heard them say, not I used to be able to do that, but I used to know how to do that.
That's interesting.
Really interesting. And I think it's exactly what you're talking about, of that, yeah, you can know it, but that doesn't mean that you always are going to know it.
Yeah.
Because you can...
Yeah, and that has to do with the body, the cells in your body you're changing constantly, and it's good, it's nice acknowledging that change.
Yeah.
Because then you also know something else once you've moved past and not knowing that first thing. And I think dance is really wrapping up a package, but like dance is so good for that kind of stuff because there's something about dancers or people who work with your body that are so, like, the questions are so fine-tuned. It's really not general.
Yes.
It's like, if you're general, then that becomes the why.
Yes.
Almost. Like, as soon as you hone into a specific detail, there's endless questions for you to just play with, whether you answer them or not.
And it's also just a lot easier to lie to yourself when you're writing or when you're talking. But when you go to do, then you're reminded that you have somehow convinced yourself that you can do a back salt. And then when you go to do it, you're like, actually, I just died. Now I'm in hospital or whatever it is. Like, you can really convince yourself and in turn convince others in words about heaps of shit.
And this is interesting in terms of, like, performativity. And, like, if I'm writing notes, I also kind of shared for the first time in this workshop that when I write notes, it seems that, like, every day when I look at the page and I look back on the page before, it's pretty much the same. And I'm actually just drawing similar graphic things to explain things or writing similar words. And it's like, well, that day, that word meant something really different from what it did the day before. But me writing again is a performative way of, like, justifying something about it or making it valid. And then, you know, even in this, like, stream of consciousness writing type task, which we also do physically in dance, that slippage between it being really authentic, I hate that word, but like how much are you performing what you're writing, whether it's only for yourself because no one else is going to read it, or if you're dancing in the studio for yourself with no one watching, you're the audience. But, and so sometimes you really slip into that, oh, I'm performing this task of free writing.
Fake it till you make it.
Yeah.
I also think, though, have you ever heard that saying that's like, if you don't want someone to read something, don't write it down?
Yeah.
So there's a safety in ephemerality across time as well.
Yes.
That you can think the thing that you thought, but if you never write it down...
The trace is
somehow... It's lost enough.
Yeah. Yeah, and I like that. It's lost enough because it's still embedded or imprinted in...
What about much, much further than your next piece? What do you think about, what do you hope that you're working on and towards and the outcome that it'll have? And
I really want to be a sound artist, like an experimental sound artist. Like, the more people I meet and talk to about their experimental sound practices, I feel a huge connection, but I also have no idea what that is. Like, I also have no information. Or maybe I do, but I also am not interested in leaving the body or leaving... working with the body is the primary, like, mode or tool. So... I think I'm slowly working towards some kind of problematic situation where I may be...
A crossroads, a juncture.
Yeah, a juncture where I not that I will, you know, then call myself a sound artist, but then that I will really know for myself that I'm working very sonically. And I don't know what that means, because maybe it means that the body is the producer of sound, not meaning that I'm like making vocals or slapping,
basically you end up becoming a singer. You're the new Celine Dion.
Oh my god, imagine that.
And you're like, I'm actually an experimental sound artist slash dancer, and this is my latest album. And you're on the head of the Titanic. And
oh my god, that would actually feel awesome.
I saw like an old burly dude on the front of one of the diesel trains the other day as we went past Southern Cross Station, and I just had a flashback to like the Australian Melbourne version of Titanic, because he was just standing right out the front of the train. Yeah, it'd be so good.
Make it. Be so tacky.
Well, that's cool. That's exciting.
Yeah, so I don't really know what that means, but I just know that that's an interest that's kind of pervaded my work so far. So I have no idea where that's going to go, and I don't...
need to worry about it.
Yeah.
Where it's going to go.
Who cares?
Well, you'll just do it.
Yeah, it'll just happen.
Ignorance and momentum are sometimes a very powerful...
That's great.
Duo.
Ignorance and momentum.
Yeah.
I like that.
Because you just don't know how hard the thing is that you've begun.
I'm going to take a note of that in my iPhone notes right now.
That's how I came into dance.
What, taking iPhone?
No, ignorance and momentum.
Who was it? Alistair McIndoe. It's hilarious. Because, I mean, his body is so strong and he has no fear in so many ways. Like... and once he was just like, Alistair, like he was playing around, and it's like, wow, your body has some serious intelligence to be able to do that without you hurting yourself. And he's like, yeah, but sometimes it's just the willpower, like the will to do something, teaches your body how to do it, because of course it doesn't want to break. So if you thrust it into a situation, not thrust as in like, you know, cascading into danger, but like, as in just kind of proposing something new, it has to deal with it. And maybe one day something will break, but then it's fine, you know, it's not that big a deal in the scale of things. Is it ignorance and momentum?
Any epiphanies to finish on, Lil? Insights that you've garnered over your long career?
I'm a baby. I'm new to this all.
Like your version of the... it's just about willpower, or...
Okay, what's my tagline? How do I market this?
Or maybe even it's that... what you're talking about, that quite often in your notebook you'll find that you've written the same thing that you wrote the day before. Maybe this is something that you keep reminding yourself about or telling yourself that puts you in the right space to be able to access all the things that you want.
I feel like it's all just about energy. I mean that in lots of ways, I guess I could break down, but I won't.
Yeah, like fructose.
Yeah.
But also love.
Yeah.
But also Newton's laws.
Yeah, exactly. You got it.
Yeah.
Yeah, like, I mean, yeah, I think that dance especially, or everything, is about energy, exchange and production and absorption. And it's also, I can't help but think about how to say this. I guess it's like you can never, like, humans can never have a non-human perspective. And I find that really interesting. But also this thing that I just saw on somebody posted on Facebook, it's like a scientific thing with some bad cartoon graphics to demonstrate it. But essentially it was like matter changes the way it behaves when it's observed. And the same is true of people in performance, or people being observed, or people feeling that they're being observed. But then on a deeper level, how when you're dancing, because we observe our body very closely, how do we tune our attention to specific, specific exchanges of energy or matter or action?
Yeah.
And how does that change the way, our cells react or act? So, maybe how can you... What was it? Epigenetics?
Yeah.
How can you do that to yourself? Just by paying attention to
your own genetics.
Yeah, how can you pay attention to your own genetics or your own cellular structure in a way that affects it for the better? Like, how can you do that for yourself?
Probably just on.
Yeah, maybe. I also have been listening to that a lot. I'm just moving with that playing.
There's a philosopher called Zizek. And he was talking about the weird thing that humans do to make themselves different from animals is to imagine that animals have mystique or have mystery or are somehow hidden from themselves, and that we try and, as humans, try and tell ourselves that that's not us, that's, we don't do that. We don't have that mystique, it's the other animals.
Yeah, it's the other.
And so we imbue them with all of this, and then that makes them the other.
Yeah.
And to consider that it's interesting to consider that that may be the crux of what's holding us
back.
What's holding us as like monospeciest in our ethical concerns.
Yeah, that's a good question.
But I also like the thing that you were talking about towards the end. Which I just had a blank on.
It's right, it's floating around. It's going to get sucked back in.
I don't know, it's gone.
That's all right.
Maybe that's it. I'll listen back to this and I'll be like,
Shit.
I knew.
Can just superimpose something at the end later.
Just have a self-monologue, self-recorded monologue.
A sign-off by Matt Cornell.
And these are all the things that I didn't get to say.
That's all right.
About being watched.
Oh, yeah.
That it is just as much a skill, and you're like, anybody can dance. It's just as much a skill to be able to dance as it is to be able to be watched.
Yes.
And that maybe everybody can dance, maybe not everybody can be watched.
That's true, because it's a certain invitation, isn't it?
Yeah.
And it's, and I don't know, Deborah Hay, like, invite being seen, you know, like, you have to, and some people do that in their daily lives anyway, like, you really notice people on public transport who are sending an invitation to be seen, and that's not necessarily like being egotistical and presenting outward or like forcing your energy or image onto people.
Sometimes it's just if they see.
Yeah.
If they're seeing what's around them, then they become visible.
Yeah, and what is that thing when you just turn around and you lock eyes with somebody and you didn't know who they were, they maybe weren't looking at you. And maybe they didn't look at you because you turned around. Maybe they're already looking at you. And you just happen to catch on to that fact.